This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Jana Byers, your host, and I'm here today with Frans Kamphuyse, lecturer in medieval history at the University of Amsterdam, to talk about his new book, Scripting Justice in Late Medieval Florence, Legal Practice and Communication in the Low Courts of Utrecht, York, and Paris, out this year, 2022, with Amsterdam University Press. Good morning. Goedemorgen, Frans, and welcome to the program.
Hi.
Good morning. Yeah, that's all of my terrible Dutch I will subject you to, so be okay.
I don't mind. It's already a thing that you're trying.
That's really sweet. A little patronizing, but sweet. I like it. Okay. How are you this morning? You're over at the UvA, yeah?
Yeah, I am. Yes, yes.
And it's a little bit earlier this morning in Amsterdam for us listeners, so we'll be forgive us if we're a little slow on the uptake. All right, let's turn to the book. Okay, so you completed your PhD in 2017 at the University of Amsterdam, and so I'm guessing this is based on the work you did there, yeah?
Yeah, it is. It is based certainly on the work. It has been reworked a few times since, but it's the basis was there in 2017, certainly. Yeah.
Yeah. So your dissertation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So what led you to this topic? Why law courts?
Ah, yeah. it's something that I started working on this during my research master's, which started in 2009. So it's been, all in all, it's been quite a long project. It was something I guess happened to be led to by my then professor, Guy Geltner, who had just started at the UvA as well at that point. And he suggested at some point, why don't you have a look at court records? So it really started with court records as a kind of source that is potentially very rich, but also, let's say, sufficiently problematic to be very interesting to a historian. Maybe it's something that you'd want to discuss anyway, because it's really at the start of this project was the source, as we see often with historians, I guess.
You know, that's such a good way to go at a project. A lot of us come in with this great idea we want to explore, And that's wonderful. But then you find yourself, you know, looking for sources to meet that need, as opposed to starting with a source base and letting them tell you what they tell you in writing about that. That's a really smart way to go. But yeah, let's talk about your written source base. Let's talk about these court records. So there's, you said they're really rich. Tell us first, tell us all the good things about them. What's great about using
these sources? Well, yeah, sure. I think one of the great things about them, one is that there are surprisingly many of them, starting from a certain point. So I always tell my students, medievalists always have something to complain about. For most of the Middle Ages, it's a lack of sources, and that at the end of the Middle Ages, it's an abundance of sources. I guess this abundance is due in large part to the appearance or the coming into use of these kinds of court records, these records that courts start producing. So there's an advantage of quantity that is unknown for most of the medieval period. As I started to discover when I started to work with them, there's a fascinating diversity of these sources. I'd say in no two places do courts produce exactly the same kinds of court records. It's different parts of legal procedures that they are noting down, and lots of parts that are missing. So there's a potential richness that is at least for a medievalist, it's worthy to have a try at. Then of course some disadvantages.
There are real problems with there are real problems with every source. Let's not pretend there's a perfect source. But yeah, there are some real disadvantages to court records as well, right?
Yeah. One is accessibility. So it takes quite a lot of work and skill to work with court records, and that is something that is true not, let's say, for court records in general, but basically per case that you try to study. So, for example, what I encountered in Utrecht. Took certain skills, and then I started work on the ARC, and I had to sort of acquire some new skills. And talking about skills, that is both language skills. Some of them are written in popular languages. In some cases, you're dealing with Latin, often highly heavily abbreviated Latin, which doesn't make it easier. Plus, there's the writing, the handwriting that is very different in every case, and even within a certain case, because of course these were notaries, officials that would be keeping these records for years on end, and that would change change personality.
Right. I mean, so let's just for a quick second, I also want to remind some of our listeners may not be aware of this, but language changed considerably, right? Most people who are listening to this are going to be native English speakers. Think about Chaucer as compared to now, and that's not even this old. I mean, so, you know, we're talking about like medieval vernacular languages plus medieval Latin, which is a far cry from Cicero's beautiful language. And then sometimes, you know, a word that's 10 letters long, you have a Q and an M. And you're like, well, grand, right? So
yeah. And then they also use it interchangeably within these records. So there are, for some of these courts, say you see some documents are produced in Latin, some in French, some in Middle Dutch. So that's I presented it as a disadvantage. It is also, you can also see it as an advantage, because it does allow you to sort of to study an immense richness also language-wise, the kinds of sort of new words that you encounter in these sources. If you like to do those kinds, this kind of work, that's great.
Yeah, that is really an optimistic take. And then also, of course, there's they're part of an ongoing discussion about like how court records have a particular point of view and you don't know quite what you're getting.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that's it's been a very long discussion. I at some point I note in my book one of the sort of the basic works that may be known to broader listeners. It's Emmanuel Leroy Ladurie's Montaillou, a very famous book back when it appeared. And it took a very positive take actually on these records as potential to hear a lot of voices that we did not hear. And ever since, this debate has, of course, been, I'd say every now and then raging or continuing, because we should not forget that these sources are in many ways heavily biased, or at least heavily very complex. It is not as easy to say whose voice are we hearing exactly when we read this or this or this phrase there. And there's an evident presence of the court court officials who have a certain goal in mind. They want to make a legal case. They want to prove a certain point. But then, I mean, they do get their information from somewhere. It's not like these people that they get their information from to make their case have no voice at all. But it is not a mediated voice. So you're constantly working with these records. You're constantly sort of negotiating between all these different voices that are potentially there, trying to assess what weight you will have to attribute to them when you're reading these sources. Yeah.
Right. So the other thing, one of the points you bring up in your book that I really enjoyed and kind of gave me something new to think about is, historians largely work from written records, not exclusively, but largely. And in part, that's what we have. And then there are disciplinary boundaries of like what we tend to treat as text and what is reliable. But there's a lot that we miss in that. And you're trying to remedy that here. So talk to me about the, and I'm quoting from you, non-textual forms of communication that comprise the legal process.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's something that I'm continuing being interested in, the way in which we as historians can actually also look beyond texts without necessarily taking on the jobs of archaeologists, architectural historians, etc. Because a lot of great work is done there within these neighboring disciplines. And I think it's something that historians can really profit from. So we have, for example, what I noticed when I started studying these three courts is that, to my mind, a court is more than just a body of people that are doing justice, so to say. But at least to my interpretation, a court is also a place where you can go. And this is an aspect, for example, that I've highlighted in my book, the spatial history of these courts, which is something that is, in a few cases, you see it treated. There's a literature by architectural historians on it existing, but they have their own points of interest. But for a lot of these courts, actually, I had to delve into very sort of marginal detailed notes by historians and architectural historians to simply give an impression of where were these court sessions taking place. And then you see that there was an immense diversity. So we have a lot of sort of open air activity that is taking place. But for example, in the case of York and ecclesiastical court, most of these court sessions were very probably taking place within the cathedral. And I know you may have visited a cathedral every now and then. It does do something with your experience of what's going on there. It brings something to the event that's taking place there. And so that is an example of a way in which considering the spatial surroundings of where these courts were taking place, to my mind already brings something extra about what taking part in a court case may or will have meant for people at the time, and what it will have brought, apart from simply that what we read in the text. So that's a one example of that let's say what I call non-textual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there is a difference when you walk into the Stadthaus or when you walk into the cathedral. You're talking to God then. God is watching these proceedings, right? There's also, these diagrams in your book where I could see all the different spaces, and I could imagine the rituals of like walking through and being paraded. Just, we'll get to punishment and like we'll get to that in a minute, but just walking through the space in front of all of these people who are going to question you, and that you can, that would change the experience as opposed to just walking into someone's office, you know, and talking to someone across the table. Yeah, very, really interesting and a kind of a neat way to think about the, you know, the past.
Let's say what I've tried in that sense is to provide, so to speak, a sort of a broader palette of experiences that go beyond these simple things that we read in the text, or at least integrate these texts that we read within what they will have done or will have meant in a broader context of experiences of people that were participating in them. Yeah,
brilliant. Yeah, I love that. Another question: when you're conceiving of this study, you know, thinking, "Yeah, I'm going to do my dissertation," that'll be a huge hurdle for the between me and my future. What made you think you should do three cities?
Yeah, that was a challenging discussion or decision in the end. One reason for that, there are always several reasons. One main reason for that was that the historiography that I'm building on is already very rich, and some of the aspects that I'm treating are fortunately to an increasing degree also used by other historians. The only thing that I noted was that there's a tendency to then really focus on one case study, one region, one bounded, territorially bounded space. So for me, it is also an effort to see in which I could, connect source bases, but also connect historiographies. I've noticed an immense difference between, the Dutch historiography on urban courts, English historiography on the one hand, ecclesiastical, on the other hand, royal courts, and then what the French, for example, are doing in their historiography something like this Parlement de Paris, which is a royal court, really sort of involved in a larger state building project. And so it was an attempt to see how this sort of this basic model of the courts was, to a sense, put in practice in different places, also at different skills of organization. That's the main reason that I thought this could be a very productive a comparison for the book.
You're right. It is. There are three very different systems, three very different governments, three different regions. Like there's a lot to compare, and it works really well. I mean, just I want to remember listeners, like think back to what we just said about languages, and right, there are idiosyncrasies in each document, and you're doing it across three languages. It's very impressive.
Four languages.
And I love how sometimes it's like this, there's Latin and then it falls into the vernacular and it's just, it's no language then, it's no, it's just words. I want to note that's, it's really brave. I don't know if I would have done it for my dissertation, but I'm glad you did. good. Excellent work. And I understand, I see why Utrecht, York, and Paris made sense too, these very different courts. And this is an utterly unscholarly question, but what was your favorite place to work?
Ooh, good question. Yeah. Yeah, it's hard to say because in some way or another, I have very good memories for all three parts of this research. Also because of course, especially for York and Paris, I really spent months there just sort of on location working with these sources. Yeah, it's like I have to choose between my three favorite between my three children, which of the three is the favorite one, and that's yeah, I might not want to do that.
Okay, fair enough. That's a good answer. It would be sad if you're like, oh, everywhere, but I hated being in da da da. That would be sad. I'm glad it all worked for you.
Maybe one thing that I could answer there is that thinking back of each of these cases, one of the most enjoyable, but at the same time, of course, most challenging things is starting a new case study. That is really something that's marking. Hey, you're arriving there and you're like, okay, yeah, I did some reconnaissance work beforehand to see whether there would potentially be something to work with. But you really start from, you want to know something about the local historiography, about the way in which historians have treated these sources. It's really like exploring a small sort of new world every time again, and that's really enjoyable.
and a new process in the archive, and how you talk. And a new coffee place where you're going to go get coffee, and who's the archive worker who's going to help you out the most? Like, it's, I can imagine a new adventure every time. So what is happening in courts? Who might find themselves in front of a law court, and for what reasons?
Many people for many different reasons, and that's also something that I guess that you can see in the book that apart from all the other sort of kinds of diversities that we've already talked about, not every court is receiving the same kind of people. So, for example, most of the people that I see in my Parisian court, because it was sort of a court of appeal in most cases, were often relatively rich, noble people who would at some point who would not have let a lower court's decision sort of stop them from achieving justice. Well, of course, in Utrecht, to give another example, we're really seeing the sort of the local struggles taking place. So there's really people that just they broke a window, and they now they have to sort of pay a kind of a compensation for that. So there's in that sense you feel the difference of skill in who you see there, but I'd say potentially, certainly at some point, everyone would be potentially appear in court, and that's both men and women appear as well. Men, I'd say somewhat more often. There's some discussion on that as well, but you do see both of them appear. In an indirect sense, every now and then you might even see children appear, not in person, but rather in the sense of, for example, parents that are being reproached for something that their children may have done. So in that sense, that's the also the attraction of these kinds of sources. There's a potential richness of at least sort of this kind of evidence that people have existed, even though you know no more than one line because someone did something wrong. You have a kind of evidence of existence of people there.
Right. And you can see, I mean, there are things that happen before you get to court. I mean, you can see, right, these, the broken window. What is that about? Did somebody just accidentally break a window, or is this an ongoing feud that they're going to tell you about?
I think in this case, it doesn't directly look like an ongoing feud, but it's more sort of the problem with the broken window is that it is, if I remember correctly, I think also that it is done by night. So there's sort of this larger issue of disturbing a sort of nightly peace and also disturbing an urban peace more in general. So you see that in different ways, these seemingly small kinds of misbehavior can become very problematic as soon as they touch on something like the, let's say, the peace and quiet that is supposed to rule in this urban community. Now, that's a theme that I think you see in a lot of these courts. This idea of we have to, let's say, guarantee a certain peace and order, and that is something that can be broken simply by breaking a window.
Yeah, and that's a great example of how it's not just about what's happening in court, right? You get this much broader view of life in this place. And so what is brought to court, to these courts in particular, right? Because there are other courts, there are ecclesiastical courts, there's just kind of village justice, we won't get into that. Like, there's all these levels. So you can see what is going to interest the secular authorities, which is wonderful and fascinating. And then there's this, you speak about the rituals of punishment as well, right, of how things are handled. So can you tell us some examples of these rituals? I'm interested in the forgiveness ritual, for instance.
Yeah,
what is that?
Yeah. It's something that I see it basically in the Utrecht sources, but we have all kinds of similar sort of appearances of it in York, but especially in Paris as well on different levels. So it is a much broader phenomenon. In French, they have the term amende honorable for it as well. There's this you might call it a tradition or a broader sort of communication structure where people are going to have to publicly beg a certain forgiveness for things that they have done. And the reason that it struck me was basically that in the Utrecht sources, it is simply one of the most common ways of treating all kinds of misbehavior. Right? You constantly see people sort of making up with the town rather than with a specific individual, but making up with the town for things that they have done. And then it is dressed up as as I say in my book, with all kinds of sort of echoes of different traditions of penitence, of saying you're sorry for something that you've done. And so there's this, let's say there's a certain repertoire of acts that is being drawn upon to construe these rituals of forgiveness, as they are called. Mm-hmm.
And so the public nature of it is you're demonstrating that you owe something to your community, right? But it also then serves as a warning to others.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, I dare say, of course, and that's where the what you might call a communication repertoire kicks in. These courts, they do want to bring a message, which is a warning, but it's also, I mean, it is more than a warning. It is also a sort of look what happens when you do something wrong. We are the ones who are treating these wrongdoings in a proper way. So don't do anything wrong and trust in us that if something goes wrong, that we will make sure to resolve it in a satisfactory manner. And to bring such a message, what at least to my idea, what they are drawing upon is this sort of this sign language that is includes the way the culprit is dressed, for example, dressed as in a very penitential way, very simple clothing, often no shoes, nothing on his head, to reference a probably very well known way of penitential behavior. It is a sign language that we know for many different periods, many different places. And so there, by in lack of a sort of, to our mind, an explicit message that is exactly saying what I just told you, they're referencing well-known tropes how to make up for the things that you've done wrong.
What penitence looks like. Yeah. But from where else might we see this sort of behavior?
As soon as you start sort of looking at it, you see it basically everywhere, but a very convincing, a very clear link is already made by, in a book by Mary Mansfield, the late Mary Mansfield, who links these kinds of performances to what she basically sees as the episcopal role in urban governments. She's basically focused on the north of France in a slightly earlier period, but she's talking about exactly the same kind of sign language that was used, first of all, by bishops who knew it from this sort of this penitential tradition, and then clearly taken over by secular authorities who were, in that sense, echoing a well-known penitential way of organizing these penal rituals, so to speak. So there you can relatively clearly trace the way in which this way of working spreads. But it is something that is, I think one example that I use from way back is also for example the way to Canossa, the very famous sort of high medieval event where the emperor was sort of called or wanted to come before the Pope to say sorry for things he had done. And there again, in the descriptions you have of it, you see the same kind of dress described, the same kind of movement described. So for what must already have been a very well-known story of an event in this also in the later Middle Ages, it's interesting to see that there, in a sense, there's an ablation of the of these types of events.
And so the event at Canossa, which is about a power struggle between secular power and religious power, and you have the secular power literally lowered, right, like on his knees in this very clear sign that then really is going to be resounding for a window breaker in Utrecht, right, or for someone who doesn't pay their taxes or whatever it is that is happening. It's a series of references then that would be, I'm trying to think of something that modern people would understand, just that, you know, but an idiom, a way of speaking that would just make perfect sense to everyone around there.
I think you have all kinds of modern examples of that as well. Just something that springs to mind. Political leaders walking around with a child on their arm, for example, you know, the kind of who's going to believe this, but it's apparently still seems to work because some of them are still doing it. Drawing on these ideas of what idealized behavior looks like. What is the ideal way of
right. of, uh, yeah and little bits of theater that are easily read, like riding your tractor to Parliament, for instance, on the first day. These are things that are going to make a lot of sense to this contemporary audience. So then reading those, you can like trace back and see what this broader unspoken or like what you can see patterns of behavior that you're not reading.
Yeah, exactly. And then you see them, especially in these Utrecht sources, you see them repeated so often. Hey, it's really, I'd say several times a year, you would, if you would be living in Utrecht, you would be seeing this kind of ritual taking place. And so, there you're always in the as a historian, you always have to ask: is the authority simply so sort of stubborn that they keep doing something that no one understands, or are they doing it because they do seem to understand what is the kind of language that seems to work to get the message across?
So, and if you live in Utrecht and you see this happen all the time, and you stop and take part in it, right? So then there's a way that the whole rest of the community becomes involved.
Yeah, yeah. It's a part of the let's say of the work that is often the most complex. It is getting a sense of the exact audience of these kinds of events. The issue is often audiences are hardly ever are explicitly named. So a lot of it, you have to construe by reading these messages that are sent. Are these communications actually meant for a specific audience, or do they seem to assume that there's an audience there? If things like this, like these for example, these forgiveness rituals are taking place in open air, or to take an example from the your case, in the cathedral that was potentially hosting a lot of other activities, and you can at some point, you can at least you can take the assumption that the event will at least have been seen or heard by people in the specific locality, assess the way the power of the crowd, the power of the audience, by understanding how these messages, these ritualized messages, are often very intricately construed to bring certain messages across, and often in multiple ways through multiple media. So things are written down, things are performed in certain places to sort of profit from the public character of a place, or the implications that doing something in a church may bring to what you're doing there. To my mind, the audience is clearly present without these, let's say, the explicit evidence of this and this and this and this person was there and was looking at this.
But I mean, we do know where these are happening, and we know there are people there. We know that this is happening in some of the busiest squares in Venice. It happens right by the Rialto Bridge, right? We know that people are coming.
These places are not chosen just because it's a nice bridge or it's a nice play, a nice square. No, and they're often also related. For example, you very often see things happening on market days on squares. Well, that's for a reason, because people were around to witness. Yeah. So again, there you see that these sources do not explicitly say, and these people were there, or there were a lot of people, you can assume that on a market day, on a busy square, that there were people witnessing this, and that the authorities will have used this sort of to try and get their message across. Whether they will have succeeded, that's of course another thing, or in which way they will have succeeded. But
how this is read is a whole nother question. So, and I'm interested really quickly, like, this has got to be different in Utrecht from Paris, right? Like what's happening in Paris is involving this very different, I'm guessing you don't see a lot of people in the Paris courts who are told to take off their hats and walk down Market Street.
Even though in Paris itself, that does happen, but then there, most cases in Paris are then treated by another sort of, another court, not by this sort of royal high appeal court. You do, but in a different sense, have some evidence for an audience of these occasions. For example, what is has become very clear in the Parisian case is that most of these cases were taking place within the royal palace, which is still in some sense standing there, even though not in the. it's still the Palace of Justice currently in Paris, so there they are actually they're much more intricately sort of managing space, who can be where at what moment, and they have a clear distinction, for example, between sort of secret meetings. Well, secret is maybe a strong word, but these at least secluded meetings, where, let's say, the court members would be talking to each other about a case, and then the more sort of public pleading events, or pleading, I should say, maybe. I'm always confusing the pronunciation of these. For this second type of event, even though we do not exactly know who would then be sort of standing there listening to what was going on, we do see, for example, all kinds of officials that are specifically given the task of making sure the order in the courtroom itself is managed, making sure no one is secretly stealing things from other from people attending the court session. And so there again, you have in many ways indirect evidence of a certain crowd being there, present to witness the event, even though it will have been a very different crowd from the one that would have been standing in the Utrecht Square.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So this kind of leads to one of the bigger questions about the role of justice in courts in the medieval and into the early modern period as well, right? So who's standing in, you know, very early on, the idea is to get people to sleep, like 7th century early on, is to get people to stop taking care of this themselves with familial violence, but instead to go to courts. And in this period, we're seeing an expansion, right? And some historians would argue that this is the centralization of power. You're seeing this in Utrecht, but also then you're seeing it in played out with a different group of people in Paris. Where do you stand on this? What do you think? What does your work tell us about this ongoing debate about the centralization of power?
I think certainly there's I'm usually a slightly how would you call this? There's a risk. Let me put it like this. There's always a risk to take a specific centralizing discourse from these authorities themselves as sort of a direct reflection of what is actually happening. There is centralization taking place, but that does not mean that we're talking about this kind of teleological sort of development. What we do see is that there are all kinds of authorities that have, for example, state building projects, but I would say they're in many ways, certainly in this period, but maybe later on, they're in a kind idealized projects. They want to centralize, they want to have a sort of an absolute control of everything. What you then see in practice is that, of course, the more you try to centralize, the more difficult it becomes. In many ways, you could say that this Utrecht court, simply by being concerned with one locality, is in a way much more centralized than the complex way in which, for example, the Parlement de Paris has to manage the whole expanding realm of the French kings, or the French kings have a certain. So I'm trying to draw the development of these courts away from simply this sort of this centralizing state building discourse, and by putting the focus on these moments of interaction that we've been talking about, the way in which legal authorities are drawing upon certain tropes, certain communicative repertoire to convince an audience, to convince people of their role in, the larger theater of things that's going on, without denying that of course some of this, the centralization will probably have worked because it's also what we see. I also want to clearly focus on the way in which there are so many, forces pulling other ways. It's not a run race. Not in the late medieval period. I would say maybe even up till today, you can put your questions at the sort of the unidirectional idea of centralization. I think in many ways there's a decentralization actually currently taking place in many areas. So it's in that sense, trying to write a history of institutions and societies without sort of following this teleological discourse that these institutions themselves often present in writing that we've based. We base so much of our idea of history on.
I mean, I think the idea that that these things are done in public, right? Or at least, I mean, if you're talking about the Parlement de Paris and before the people who are invested, right? The fact that the court feels required to demonstrate to people and get the populace involved is already a demonstration of this kind of back and forth. But it's an interesting question, certainly, and one of those things that were like ongoing. There's one of these ongoing theological discussions about the narrative of how this progresses, which your work speaks to. So I have taken up a ton of your time already, and so I'm going to one more question, which is, what's next? What are you working on now?
What I'm working on now, several smaller projects, because what I noticed after having finished the book, where I'm really working in certain broad strokes, broad lines, I had an immense desire to get back to these sources again, because a lot of the sort of the real sort of source work that I've done for this book is already it was years ago that I really got to sort of dive into these sources. So that's something that I had a great desire for. And one of the subjects that I'm currently working on together with a colleague here in Amsterdam is this curious phenomenon of the stone fine that you may have seen in Utrecht, which is basically people are fined, but they are fined in numbers of stones,
which is odd.
It probably didn't mean that they themselves had to carry these stones to the court. In some cases, maybe, but in most cases, not. But they did have to sort of. They did have to finance a certain number of stones that could then be used for constructing works. And that's a phenomenon that already struck me during my research. I looked into it a little bit, but it's much more widespread and much less looked into than I had imagined for a curious phenomenon like that. So that's something that me and a colleague of me are currently, for example, working on.
So a little archival reset to get
your... Yeah, really, simply from the desire to dive into these archives some more after finishing the book. But that's just one sort of one thing,
Yeah, I understand, and I promise any historian who's listening understands too. Like, we just It's the archive. You got to get back there. All right. Thank you so much, Franz. It's been a wonderful conversation.
Yeah, thank you for the invitation.
And I look forward to wonderful. I really look forward to reading about the stone find. All right. Take care.
Okay. Bye.